Hello and welcome back to our class on Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2. This is its third lesson unit entitled Practice and Theory of Rheology. Before we get into that matter, I'd like to start with a little personal remark. You will hear throughout this audio stream that its sound quality is improved a lot compared to the two first ones. The reason for that is that a good microphone, which I've ordered quite some time ago already now, has finally been delivered. We all find ourselves in special times at this moment due to the public and economical lockdown caused by the pandemic of the coronavirus pathogen, which is actually the reason why you're listening to a digital lecture here, by the way, that would normally be given to you in a classical lecture hall format. And this also changes a lot the way of how we purchase goods, shifting classical personal contact shopping situations into an online ordering and delivery scheme. And that is apparently overwhelming and exceeding the capacity of parcel services at this stage, which also affected this digital lecture in a sense that the good microphone has taken some longer than expected to be delivered. I can take this opportunity to tell you a little about the recording conditions of these audio streams, by the way. I mentioned already that we are all more or less personally concerned by the lockdown situation at the moment. I'm particularly concerned by this because I'm one of these persons who is affected by the circumstance that the child daycares, kitas, are closed. And I'm a lucky and honestly happy, but sometimes a little overworked father of an almost 3-year-old daughter who keeps me and my wife rather busy during the daytime. During the daytime, at most, I have some opportunity to do some here and there little administrative work that also is part of the academic business. At this point, I have to gratefully acknowledge Bobo Siebenschläfer and Pettersen and Findus, who helped me to distract my daughter for 10 or 20-ish minutes here and there to allow me to do little urgent administrative issues to be fixed that occur during the day. But long and concentrated work is, of course, not possible under these conditions, and that's the reason why this lecture is mostly, or I could actually say fully, recorded during the night shifts. I hope, though, that you don't hear this in the audio streams. Okay, after that little personal remark, let's get started with the matter. The last two lesson units have given us an introduction to the field of rheology. We have seen that the rheological, that means the mechanical properties of polymers, are their most relevant ones, having turned them into one of the most important material classes in material science and engineering. The reason is that polymers, in contrast to many classical materials, are capable of displaying either and both elastic and viscous properties and all the grayscales in between. They display rich viscoelastic mechanics, and that makes them interesting for a variety of applications. And as we will see, by the way, later throughout this lecture, they are not even fixed to one of these grayscales, but the grayscale can be tuned by experimental parameters, making polymers display more their viscous properties under these conditions and more their elastic properties under those conditions. So that means their mechanics is actually well controllable. In this present lesson unit, we now aim to substantiate that initial insight and learned about two aspects. The first one is, how are mechanical properties of polymers, and also other materials, actually experimentally probed? What techniques are available for that purpose, and how do they work conceptually? And in a second focus of this class, we want to supplement to that experimental view a theoretical view, and see by what kind of theoretical models we can assess and quantify the viscoelastic properties that we probe in those experiments. We have seen already in our last lesson units that there is two complementary material parameters that capture viscoelastic properties, just as the word says, the viscosity and the elasticity, expressed in terms of the elastic modulus. In the two elementary laws of mechanics, Hooke's law of elastic solids and Newton's law for viscous liquids, they both serve as constant of proportionality, expressing the extent of resistance that a material exerts on deformation. In the elastic case, such that energy invested to work against that resistance can be gained back upon relief of the load, whereas in the case of viscous materials, this energy is dissipated to heat. In both cases, however, there is a resistance against which we have to work when attempting to deform the material. So in an experiment, we must generally find a way to probe that resistance. The most common and widespread experimental method to do so is the method of oscillatory shear rheology. What we do in this method is, we place our sample specimen between two measurement geometries. The lower one is a plane plate, and the upper one either also is a plane plate or has the shape of a cone. And then we turn the upper part, the upper geometry, into an oscillatory motion and measure how hard this is, which we detect in terms of the torque that is exerted by the sample medium's resistance in between these two geometries. From that, we can calculate the complex moduli, whose real and imaginary parts deliver us information on the energy storage and loss capabilities of the material. The two measurement situations that I have just described are visualized to you in figure number 71 in our script. Panel A shows the plate-plate geometry, panel B shows the cone-plate geometry. There are specific pros and cons for and against either of these geometries, which I don't want to discuss here because that goes into detail, whereas we are more interested in conceptual grounds. As said already, this methodology is the most widespread and easy to apply method. It basically just has one severe drawback. To get a good measurement signal, we need a decent amount of material, typically about 0.5 milliliter at least. From your previous experiences in preparative synthetic polymer chemistry, you may get a feeling here already that this can be quite some investment. Sometimes in research, you barely have that much of material. So there is need for methods that consume less of material sample. Such a methodology is named microrheology, and in addition to this practical advantage of consuming less material, it also has very fundamental scientific advantages over the classical shear rheology method. What we do in this methodology is we load our sample specimen with nano or micrometer sized probe particles and then use those to explore the material. By and large, we explore how hard or easy it is for these probe particles to move inside the sample matrix, which then allows us to draw conclusions, meaning to calculate viscoelastic properties of the sample matrix. As these probes are small, such information is actually obtained locally. And if we probe this in a spatially resolved fashion, meaning if we observe the motion of these particles underneath an optical microscope, for example, we can actually deliver maps of local viscoelastic properties, which may in fact vary as a function of the spatial coordinate throughout the sample medium, and thereby delivering us information on mechanical spatial heterogeneity. When conjuncting this with information that we have gained about structural inhomogeneity, assessed by other methods, we find ourselves right in an interesting field of materials research. How does structure, specifically an inhomogeneous one, correlate to properties, potentially also an inhomogeneous one? We can basically distinguish between two variant forms of microrheology, referred to as active and passive microrheology. As the words indicate already, in active microrheology, the probe particles that are immersed in the sample medium are displaced actively by the application of active external forces. Whereas in passive microrheology, also as the name already indicates, the probe particles move passively, simply driven by their ever-present thermal motion. The kind of sample that we are primarily interested in is a polymer sample, for example, a semi-dilute or concentrated polymer solution or a polymer melt. And the loading of such a sample specimen with probe particles is sketched to you in figure 72 of the script. Let's discuss these two variant forms of microrheology in a little more detail each. We start with focusing on active microrheology. As indicated already, what we do in this variant is we actively exert a force onto the particles to put them into motion. The prime representative method of this kind is magnetic bead rheology, where the sample is loaded with magnetic microparticles that can be moved by application of an external magnetic field. This field exerts a magnetic force onto the particles, as expressed in equation 5.14. This force causes a motion of the beads down the gradient of the magnetic field, which can be monitored by microscopy, for example, and then translated into viscoelastic properties in a spatially resolved fashion. Let's discuss this first for a purely viscous medium, because that's, as we will see, the easiest case. In this case, the application of the magnetic force, as expressed in equation 5.14, accelerates the particles, which is then accompanied by the emergence of a counteracting frictional force. That always happens if we put particles into motion in a viscous, energy-dissipating external medium. If the particles are spherical, then we can estimate this frictional force according to Stokes' law, where the frictional force is proportional to the particle velocity, and the constant of proportionality is composed of a geometrical factor and the medium's viscosity. In a steady state, the accelerating and the decelerating force are at balance, and the particles reach a constant velocity, which we can measure by a suitable method, for example, video microscopy. The force balance situation is balanced in equation 5.15 of the script, which we can now rearrange to the parameter that we want to probe, which is the viscosity. So we simply obtain the viscosity by measuring the velocity of the probe particles subject to a certain external magnetic field. A more general and also more interesting case for us, specifically if we consider polymer samples, is the case of a viscoelastic sample. As we have seen already in the last lesson unit, the properties of such samples are best captured in an oscillatory experiment. We can achieve that by applying an oscillatory alternating magnetic field That puts the particles in an accordingly oscillating time-dependent displacement, as expressed in equation 5.16. And by a further mathematical approach similar to the one we've just discussed for the purely viscous case, we can from that obtain information about the storage and the loss properties of the sample medium, which is the storage and the loss moduli, as expressed in the equation pair 5.17. We see already how versatile and powerful this methodology is. It just has one possible drawback, and that is the exertion of an external force is first of all experimentally demanding and may already cause alternation of our sample. If the particle motion is actuated by a too strong force, this may destruct local structures in the sample already, and thereby we probe something while also actively changing it. Footnote, this is like in quantum mechanics, huh? There we always modify the thing we observe. To circumvent this potential drawback, the method of passive microrheology gives us means at hand. In this method, we don't apply any external additional force to put the particles into motion, but just let the ever-present thermal energy KBT do this job. We just sit and observe the particle motion subject to this ever-present thermal energy. This delivers us a data set of the probe's mean square displacement as a function of time. We observe a number of particles and track how far each particle goes as a function of time, and then we calculate the mean square of that. We know from elementary physical chemistry that for a normal Fickian purely diffusive motion, this should follow the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation. This is number 518 in the script. It tells us how far a diffusing particle gets on average per time. Notable here is that time scales linearly to the mean square displacement, simply meaning the more time we give, the more do the particles displace on average, measured in terms of the mean square of the displacement. The constant of proportionality in that equation consists of a geometrical factor, which is 2 for a random walk in one geometrical dimension, 4 for a random walk in two geometrical dimensions, and 6 for a random walk in three geometrical dimensions, which is the case given in the equation in our script here, and an additional factor that quantifies the mobility of the moving species. This is abbreviated with the symbol D and referred to as the translational diffusion coefficient. Footnote here, this is a scaling law expression very related to the elementary scaling law of polymer physical chemistry, namely that the mean square size, to be precise, the mean square end-to-end distance of a random Gaussian polymer coil, scales in proportion with the number of segments in it. R square is proportional to n. Conceptually, we can also conceive the diffusive motion of a particle as a sequence of distinct steps. Thereby, we replace the continuous variable t in equation 518 by a discontinuous step sequence, each of which having a step duration tau. In this variant, the mean square displacement also scales linearly with a number, namely the number of steps. And with that, this variant form of the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation is practically the same as the scaling law for the size of an ideal chain. This conceptual similarity, of course, has a reason. The shape of an ideal chain as captured within the phantom model is the one of a random walk. It is a sequence of segments with defined segmental length, just as the steps in the diffusive path have a defined length, and with random angles between each step, causing a self-crossing random walk. In this modeling, segments of the chain can actually occupy the same spots in space, just as the random walk path of a diffusing particle can also exhibit self-crossing, as it has no memory. This is why we name these chains phantom chains, because the segments there are like bodiless phantoms that can penetrate through each other. In chemistry, the Einstein-Smoluchowski law has very broad utility. If you, for example, work in the biomedical field and are developing a drug delivery formulation, with the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation, you can calculate how long it takes for this formulation, which may be polymer or nanoparticle based, to reach a certain target site in the cell by diffusive motion. And from such considerations, you may get to the conclusion that the formulation must be somehow made smaller, because in its present size that it may presently have during a development process, it just takes too long to reach a certain target site, and thereby failing its actually intended utility. Another field of application would be the field of chemical technology. If you, for example, think about the process of printing electronic grids onto carrier foils to get form-adaptable microchips, you are generally interested in achieving a high resolution. With the Einstein-Smoluchowski law, you can calculate how far the molecules of that formulations will diffuse after the printing process during the cooldown period when they are still mobile. And this may lead to a result that, for example, within the time frame of 1 second, which may be the time it takes for your printed microstructure to solidify, the molecules can actually diffuse distances of, let's say, 10 micrometers. This means that any attempt to print resolutions smaller than 10 micrometers is obsolete. because these will fade and smear during the solidification time of the print. We will now use the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation to appraise, for example, the viscosity of a medium in which probe particles diffuse. This is expressed in equation 5.19 of the script. This equation is actually based on the Stokes-Einstein equation, which establishes a relation between the diffusion coefficient of a spherical particle and the variables temperature, the hydrodynamic radius of the particle, and the viscosity of the surrounding medium. Here this equation is rearranged for the parameter viscosity and then reads that the viscosity is equal to thermal energy kBT over 6 pi diffusion coefficient times hydrodynamic radius. And this diffusion coefficient is now replaced by the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation 5.18 to give us the most right-hand form of equation 5.19. Plugging in the value of a mean square displacement achieved at a certain time point d, in addition to temperature and radius of the particle, we obtain the medium's viscosity. This, however, only works reliably if the mean square displacement scales linear with time, as predicted by the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation 5.18. This, however, is only given in purely viscous samples. In elastic samples, by contrast, we have something different. Here, a probe particle initially is mobile, but as soon as it starts to feel the surrounding elastic constraint by the medium, its mean square displacement levels off on a plateau. This is shown to you in figure 73 of the script. Here, we use the plateau value to estimate the elasticity of the surrounding medium. The approach for that is a very simple one. We assume that the surrounding elasticity is given by something like Hooke's law, and the actuating energy is kBT. In the limit of equilibrium displacement, which is the most possible displacement that the thermal actuation can deliver, we have these two energies at balance, as expressed in equation 5.20. And if we take this energy and normalize it to the size of the probe particles, we get an expression for the elastic modulus, as denoted in equation 5.21. From these two extremes, we can directly get to the intermediate situation of a viscoelastic medium. From the discussion of the time-dependent mean square displacement in figure 73, we have seen already that its slope delivers us information on what the state of viscoelasticity of the sample is. If the slope is 1, then this means that the mean square displacement scales linear with time, denoting a viscous sample. If that slope is 0, meaning if there is no slope but a plateau has been reached, this denotes to us no more time-dependent scaling of the mean square displacement, as we have in a purely elastic medium, where the thermal energy kBT can displace a probe particle to a certain finite extent that is reached when the driving thermal energy is at equilibrium with the dragging elastic energy. Intermediate cases are now expressed by a generalized form of the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation, as denoted by equation number 5.22. Here we have a general scaling of the mean square displacement with time with a power law exponent alpha. If this exponent is 1, we have the case of a purely viscous medium. If this exponent is 0, we have the case of a purely elastic medium. And if this exponent is something in between, we have a viscoelastic case. The more it is on the 0 side, the more viscous is the material. The more it is on the 1 side, the more elastic is the material. The probe diffusive motion is then referred to as a subdiffusive motion. As according to the generalized law 5.22, the displacement of the particle with time is less than it would be in a normally diffusing case. In general, what causes such subdiffusive motion in materials is dragging or trapping of the probe particle. When the probe particle is somehow dragged or trapped upon its way, its time-dependent displacement is impaired or inhibited, so to speak, and thereby exhibits less of an extent as it would be without that trapping or dragging. Footnote, an illustrative, somehow everyday life example, at least during the summer times, is a wine fest in Mainz. If a person is at a wine fest in Mainz and has enjoyed the wine a little too much, its walk motion is then that of a random walk, a random sequence of steps. We can assess how far this person gets on average by quantifying the time-dependent mean square displacement from the origin of that walk. Footnote to the footnote here. You may recall from Physical Chemistry 1 and also from part 1 of this lecture series where we have quantified the random walk statistics that the most likely displacement then is 0. This is a physical explanation for why you cannot escape a wine fest. Physics just doesn't allow that. In that picture, we can now also take into account the condition of trapping or dragging. If the wine stands are still open, every time that randomly walking person hits a wine stand, may be tempted to spend a little time there and is thereby trapped on the motion. The mean square displacement of that person is then less than linear in time. The walk is subdiffusive. In figure 73, we see that the extent of subdiffusivity of the motion of the probe particles in a viscoelastic medium increases as time proceeds. Initially, the particles explore so little distances only that they don't yet feel any entrapment. As they explore larger distances, however, they more and more feel the elastic part of the viscoelastic properties of the surrounding medium and therefore more and more get trapped. As a result, the slope of the curve in figure 73 gets shallower with time, which in view of equation 5.22 means that the scaling law exponent alpha decreases. This in turn denotes us that the elastic properties gain importance as time proceeds. The time dependence of the scaling law exponent alpha therefore has to do with the extent and magnitude of the extent of contribution of the loss and storage parts of the complex modulus. Mathematizing this, as has been done for example by Mason and Waitz, gives mathematical expressions of these two, as denoted in the equation triple 5.23. Alright, now we know how to probe viscoelastic properties. We have shed a view onto the experimental side of rheology. Let's shed a complementary view now on the theoretical aspects. The experiments that we have discussed so far will deliver us data sets for the time, or we can also inversely say frequency-dependent, viscoelastic properties of our medium. Is there ways to fit these data sets to analytical model functions that lead back to conceptual models? Yes, of course. There is a myriad of models available, all essentially tracing back to two fundamental ones, which we want to discuss now. The first one is the Maxwell model for viscoelastic fluids. We have seen in our last lesson unit that the stereotype mechanical elements for an elastic solid is a spring, and the stereotype mechanical element for a viscous fluid is a dashpot. An intuitive, very simple way to model a viscoelastic material is just to take the two of those and connect them in series. This is shown to you in figure 74 of the script. We can already say intuitively how this combined mechanical element should behave if we exert an external deforming force. In this case, the elastic spring will deform instantly, followed by a delayed, irreversible deformation of the dashpot that then relaxes the stored stress in the deformed spring. This relaxation may come to completion, thereby fully relieving the stress, or it may be incomplete, leaving a certain residual stress in the system. Once we release the external stress, however, the spring element will snap back to its original position, whereas the dashpot element will remain deformed irreversibly. We can also quantify this in mathematical expressions as follows. We can intuitively say that upon deformation, the stress in this combined mechanical element will be the same in both its parts, whereas the total strain is additive by the two parts. The same also holds true for the derivative of the strain, leading us to equation 5.24. We already know the differential equation that captures the spring element, that's Hooke's law. We also express it in differential form here in equation 5.25. We also know the equation for the viscous damper element, that's Newton's law, equation 5.26. If we take these two letters and insert those in equation 5.24, we obtain equation 5.27. This is the differential equation describing the Maxwell model element to us. Solving it with a boundary condition of constant deformation, meaning d epsilon over dt is 0, gives us equation 5.28. This equation quantifies the time-dependent relaxation of stress in the Maxwell element. We can write it in two forms. The left-hand side form is the one we obtain from solving the differential equation 5.27, and the right-hand form is a generally kind of writing with a general mathematical expression of an exponential decay, which is e to the minus t over tau. In this notation, tau is a time constant. From a purely mathematical viewpoint, it denotes to us the time it takes until the property of interest, here the stress, has relaxed back to an increment of 1 over e of its original value. We will see in some minutes, and also several times again in the further course of this lecture series, that in rheology this time is one of the most elementary material parameters. By comparison of the two variant forms of equation 5.28, we can furthermore see already one of the most elementary equations in the field of rheology, which is tau is equal to viscosity over elastic modulus. Connecting the two elementary material parameters, viscosity and elastic modulus, to that elementary time constant. This central equation, tau is equal to eta over e, here at this point somehow fell from the sky. We've got to it sort of as a, let's say, mathematical byproduct, so to speak. In the next lesson unit, we will also derive it more conceptually and thereby realize its deep fundamental basis and meaning. Okay, now, as just said, let's consider the time constant tau a little more from the conceptual viewpoint. Phenomenologically, we have just seen it denotes to us the time it takes until stress in a material specimen has been relaxed to a residual portion of 1 over e of its initial. microscopically, such stress relaxation must come from somewhere. It comes from rearrangement of the building blocks, meaning the molecules or particles that constitute a sample. This rearrangement takes some time. On short timescales, only little, maybe even negligible rearrangement is possible. On long timescales, strong, meaning considerable rearrangement is possible. As a consequence, on short timescales, little stress relaxation is possible, whereas on long timescales, extensive stress relaxation is possible. The relaxation time now denotes to us the boundary between these two extremes. On a microscopic scale, it is the time that it takes for a molecule or particle, for a building block of our material, to move a distance equal to its own size. On timescales longer than that, the molecules or particles, in our case macromolecules, can move distances at least or longer than their own size, which macroscopically means there is displacement of the building blocks and thereby viscous flow. The viscous properties dominate. On timescales shorter than that, by contrast, the molecules or particles, in our case macromolecules that constitute a material, cannot yet fully rearrange. They cannot yet travel distances at least as far as their own size is, and therefore the material is not yet capable of changing its structure and thereby substantially adapting to external stress. In this case, the elastic properties dominate. At the time t being equal to tau, the one behavior transitions into the other. So here we have equal partition of both kinds of properties and a stereotype of a viscoelastic material at hand. For polymers, this time tau is in the range of some micro to milliseconds, sometimes even minutes or hours. This is a time domain that is actually covered by many practical experimental situations and also in many practical applications. That means that polymers in the world that we consider, meaning the timescales we usually consider, display rich viscoelastic mechanics. The exact value of tau now depends on how mobile the species is, which has to do with the species size, with the species shape, and with interactions between the building blocks of the material. So here, you see now why this property is so relevant. From a macroscopic engineering perspective, it tells us on what timescales the material will display more what kind of behavior. From a microscopic perspective, it directly has to do with the structure, nanoscopic topology, and interaction networks within the material. This is exactly what we want to focus on in our lecture, relations between structure and properties. Both is reflected in the time constant tau. In the Maxwell model, this central parameter denotes to us the extent of stress relaxation duration. With that, the Maxwell kind of model is a very good, simple approach to assess the properties of a viscoelastic fluid that is capable of showing such stress relaxation. Is it also as good for the opposite case, for the viscoelastic solid that more has energy storage than relaxation capabilities? In this case, we consider the opposite situation, not of a constant strain, but of a constant stress, to solve the differential equation 5.27. When we do so, when we apply a constant stress, then the term of 1 over E d sigma over dt vanishes from the equation. And we just have dE over dt is equal to sigma over eta standing there. That we can rearrange for sigma, and then we have sigma is eta times dE over dt. This is nothing else than Newton's law. Meaning, here we then actually only consider the dashpot element. The spring element has sort of disappeared from our model. So from that we see that the Maxwell model is not so good for assessing such situations. We can also come to this conclusion not from a mathematical, but from a conceptual consideration. In figure 75, we have a plot of the response functions to the condition of time constant stress or strain in our material. On the left-hand side, we have the condition that we have just mathematically discussed before. That's the situation where we apply a time constant strain to a material, and the material reacts to that with a time-dependent relaxation of the accompanying stress. This is what the Maxwell element can correctly capture. On the right-hand side, we have a sketch of the opposite scenario, where we apply a time constant stress to a material and record the time constant strain. We have seen already just a minute ago that mathematically we cannot even describe this because that will fall back to purely Newton's law. Conceptually, however, we can predict how such a curve should look like. We have a certain initial response of the spring element and then a constant creep of the dashpot element, which will show to us a linear increase of the time-dependent strain. This, however, is not the kind of creep we have in viscoelastic solid materials. In this case, the time-dependent strain should show a bend over and exhibit the shape of a curve that may even lead to a plateau level. What is shown in the lower right corner of figure 75 is instead flow that sits upon some initial elastic response by the spring element. Mathematically, this type of response function is expressed to you in equation 5.30a in our script, wherein we introduce a constant of proportionality, which is the time-dependent creep compliance, as expressed in equation 5.30b of the script. We see again that this kind of response is not actually the one we observe for viscoelastic solids, as we have in fact seen in the last lesson unit. So we can conclude that the Maxwell model is very good at modeling stress relaxation in viscoelastic fluids, but not so good in modeling creep of a viscoelastic solid. With that, we have discussed the stereotype viscoelastic examples of a relaxation and a creep experiment. We have seen in our last lesson unit already that the actually really informative experiment is the dynamic one. In such an experiment, we apply a sinusoidally modulated stress or strain to a material specimen. Let us now consider a situation where a sinusoidally modulated strain is applied to the Maxwell element. The oscillatory strain can then be expressed in the form of equation 5.31a of the script, and the result of oscillating stress is expressed in equation 5.31b, both written down in integral and derivative form. To model the mechanical behavior of the Maxwell element under that experimental condition, we again start from its differential equation 5.27, which we now somehow artificially expanded by a factor of 1 that we artificially express as eta over eta on its right-hand side. This allows us to rearrange the equation as expressed in 5.32. If we now apply the fundamental law that eta is equal to the elastic modulus times tau, which we now denote as tau 0, to further stress out its fundamental relevance, to both sides of that equation, leads us to the form of equation 5.33. And if we now plug in the complex exponential functions expressed in the equation pair 5.31, we obtain the admittedly somehow lengthy equation 5.34, which we may rearrange to a shorter form as expressed in equation 5.35, which denotes us the complex elastic modulus. We can identify its two parts, the elastic and the viscous ones, as expressed in the equation pair 5.36. Whew, that has been quite some mathematics. Let's discuss this result, first from a mathematical and then from a conceptual viewpoint. It is helpful here to do this in two steps, considering the high and the low frequency regime independently first. Let's start with the low frequency regime. In that regime, the tau square omega square term in the denominators of the two equations 5.36 are small compared to the plus 1 in these two denominators. That means we can also leave them away. That only leaves the numerators of these equations, which we then can easily draw in a log-log plot. In such a plot, the elastic part of the modulus should scale as a function of the frequency with omega square, that means in a log-log representation, it should be a straight line with slope 2, whereas the viscous part scales with the frequency omega with a power law scaling of 1, that means in a log-log representation, it should be a straight line with a slope of 1. In the opposite case of very high frequencies, we can do the opposite. In this case, the tau square omega square summons in the two denominators of equation pair 5.36 are much larger than the 1 in it. So then we can ignore that 1. This leads to a situation where in the equation for E prime, meaning the storage modulus, the omega square cancels in the numerator and in the denominator, and so does the tau square, by the way, leading to a frequency-independent value of E prime of E0. In the viscous modulus, also we have a cancelling of the omega in the numerator and the omega square in the denominator, leaving us just one omega in the denominator. So here, E double prime, the viscous part of the modulus, has a frequency-dependent scaling of omega with a power of minus 1, meaning in a log-log plot representation, it should be a straight line with a negative slope of minus 1. These two regimes are separated from each other by a certain frequency where the one behavior transitions into the other. And that's the frequency that corresponds to the inverse of tau zero. If we plug that in for omega in the equations 5.36a and 5.36b, then we see that at this point, the two moduli contributions E prime and E double prime have the same value of E zero half. This result is graphically illustrated in figure 76 of the script. The storage part E prime is shown as a blue curve, the loss part E double prime is shown as a green curve. And indeed, we see that at low frequencies, the latter has a log-log scaling of plus 1, whereas the first has a log-log scaling of plus 2. Both curves coincide, that means cross each other, at the same common value of 1 half E0 at the frequency omega 0, that equals 1 over tau 0. And at higher frequencies, the elastic part of the modulus then levels off in its frequency-independent plateau value of E0, whereas the last part of the modulus E double prime drops with a log-log scaling of minus 1. After having received this mathematical insight, let's now see whether we can also understand this conceptually. What does the plot in figure 76 indicate mechanically, and how can we translate this to a microscopic picture? On the left-hand side, at low frequencies, we have dominance of the viscous modulus over the storage modulus. The green curve of E double prime has higher values than the blue curve of E prime. And these are more and more and more higher, the lower and lower and lower the frequency is. Mathematically, this is given by the shallower scaling of the green curve as compared to the blue curve. With view to the Maxwell element in figure 74, in this regime, we give the mechanical element enough time such that the damper can relax the energy stored in the spring completely. That means the mechanical properties of this element are dominated by the viscous contribution. Conceptually, this is given by the following picture. We have seen already that it takes some time for molecules to rearrange themselves. If we give them more time, which we do in the low frequency range, corresponding to the frequency range omega 0 is 1 over tau 0, meaning that if we give times greater than tau 0, we are at frequencies lower than 1 over tau 0, meaning lower than omega 0. So in this left extreme of the diagram, we are considering long timescales. Here we give the material more time than needed for molecular building block rearrangement. The more time we give them, meaning the more we go to the left side of that diagram, the better, the more can the molecules or building blocks rearrange themselves, and the more is the material capable of relieving stress, leading to a greater and greater and greater dominance of its viscous over its elastic properties the longer the time, or in other words, the lower the frequency is. The other extreme is at the other end of the diagram, on its right-hand side. Here we are considering high frequencies, corresponding to short times. Precisely, frequencies higher than omega 0, that means times shorter than tau 0. On these timescales, the material's building blocks are not yet capable of switching their positions. Less and less and less, the higher and higher and higher the frequency is. Meaning, the more we go high in frequency, the less can the material building blocks displace against each other, and that means the less can the viscous properties of the material relieve stress, but by contrast, the more do its elastic properties take over dominance. In view of the Maxwell mechanical element in figure 74, in this realm, the damper dashpot element has not enough time to be active, and the material's behavior is therefore dominated by the elastic energy storage in the spring element. The time point right in the middle between these two, the time where the frequency omega 0 matches the inverse of the relaxation time tau 0, is the regime where one scenario transitions into the other. Here the material is equally viscous than elastic. It's viscoelastic. For classical fluid materials like a glass of water, this relaxation time is very short. It's in the nanosecond range. That means such materials only display their viscous properties to us on experimentally relevant timescales. For polymers, or we can generally say for materials composed of colloidal scale building blocks, these relaxation times are a lot longer. They are in the range of micro to milli up to seconds, sometimes even minutes to hours. This makes relaxation processes very slow in these materials, meaning that they actually display the viscoelastic properties on timescales that are both experimentally and practically relevant. This makes them interesting as rich, versatile viscoelastic materials in the engineering world. This also makes them interesting from a fundamental scientific viewpoint. The basic physics of the relaxation processes in colloidal scale soft matter are the same as those in classical atomic or molecular matter. They are just a lot slower. This slowliness, combined with the large size of the building blocks, makes these processes easy to observe. The building blocks are so large that we can actually watch them while doing something, for example, while undergoing a phase transition or order phenomenon. The insights we get from that are conceptually transferable, however, to the processes in classical molecular or atomic matter, which is too small and too quick to be observed directly. This clever idea has been part of the ground of the Physics Nobel Prize in the year 1991, given to Pierre-Gilles Digène, the father of soft matter science, so to speak. With that, we have seen, I hope at least, how powerful the Maxwell model is. However, we have seen one little drawback about this model. It's not so good at modeling the creep of viscoelastic solids. It's much more suitable to model the stress relaxation in viscoelastic fluids. Is there a counterpart model available that is better in assessing viscoelastic solids? Yes, there is. It's referred to as the Kelvin-Voigt model. This model is based on a different kind of connection of a Hookean spring and a Newtonian dashpot element. We don't connect them in series here, as we do in the Maxwell element, but in parallel, as illustrated in figure 77 of the script. Here indeed, application of a time constant stress, as visualized in the upper schematic plot of figure 78, leads to a time-dependent deformational creep at a decreasing rate that asymptotically approaches a steady state value of sigma 0 over E, as indicated in the lower schematic of figure 78. As soon as we release the external stress, the material gradually relaxes back to its undeformed state, as also indicated in the right-hand side of the lower sketch in figure 78. We can again also assess and quantify this mathematically, the basis of which is again the Hooke's law quantification of the spring element in the Kelvin-Voigt model as expressed in equation 5.37 and Newton's law assessment of the viscous dashpot element in the model as expressed in equation 5.38. Here, just inverse to the Maxwell model conditions, the total strain in the element is the same in both its parts, whereas now the stresses in both parts are additive to the overall stress. When we take this Litter condition that sigma is equal to sigma 1 plus sigma 2 and plug in Hooke's and Newton's law for sigma 1 and sigma 2, we obtain equation 5.39. This is the differential equation capturing the Kelvin-Voigt element. We can again solve it, here now with the boundary condition of a time constant applied external stress, leading us to the solution function denoted in equation 5.40. In its middle representation, it shows the mathematical solution we obtain from solving the differential equation, whereas in its right-hand side representation, it shows the general mathematical form of an exponential build-up curve. Here we introduce again a time constant parameter tau, which we now name retardation time. That we may identify again by comparison of the two variant forms of the equation 5.40. This exponential build-up function correctly corresponds to the lower schematic diagram in figure 78 of the script. It describes a viscoelastic creep of a viscoelastic solid. This is what the Kelvin-Voigt model correctly comprehends and quantifies. It is, by contrast, not so good in assessing stress relaxation in a viscoelastic fluid. But for that we have a different model, the Maxwell model. There has been further desires by material scientists to develop a comprehensive model that captures both behaviors. One quite well-known approach is the one of combining a Maxwell and a Kelvin-Voigt element together as shown in figure 79 of the script. It's named the Burgas model. This already shows a quite detailed mechanical response function, as illustrated in the right-hand side schematic of figure 79. This, however, comes on cost of more complex and somehow frightening mathematical equations. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. We have learned about both the practice and theory to probe and predict the rheological characteristics of viscoelastic materials. Specifically, the second part of this class has been quite mathematical, but what we have seen always there is how powerful these approaches are. On a purely mathematical way, in this case by solving differential equations, we have obtained predictions of material behavior, the most relevant one being the characteristic time constant, that have certain key relevance. And from that, we have then gotten to conceptual insight and connected this to a nanoscopic structural material picture. With that, we are right at the goal of this lecture series already, deriving structure property relations. This is exactly what customers will approach you for when you are finding yourself as being a materials developing chemist somewhere in the industries later on. Customers or users will not approach you with a desire to get a certain chemical structure from you. What they want is a function. Your obligation now is to translate that function into a measurable material parameter. For example, if a customer is interested in a polymer-based formulation for pillow or mattress furnitures that distinct themselves by very comfortable damping when sitting or laying on those, you know now in what material property to translate this, into the creep compliance. You now also know in what kind of experimental situation and what type of elementary mechanical modeling this plays a key role, and how this translates very conceptually and illustratively to material structure. You can also then appraise in what time range the relaxation time of this material should lay to deliver this comfortable functional feeling. And you also got a glimpse on already how this further translates into chemical characteristics, namely into size, shape, and interactions of the building blocks that constitute the material. This will give you a guideline at hand into which direction to seek for to find a chemical structure that will eventually deliver this function. And with your chemical preparative synthetic knowledge, you can then also tell how to make this material. Further then, along the way of materials development, you have to consider further aspects such as economical, environmental, and safety-related issues that will most likely rule out several ideas that you have. But in the end, this process will lead you to a promising kind of chemical structure that can be made with a promising synthesis scheme, and that will eventually show these properties, that will have a relaxation time in the desired range, and that will then thereby display a creep compliance of desired magnitude and time dependence. which then for the customer or user appears the way it was intended to appear. With that, the desired function has been delivered. There is one thing that we have ignored so far, namely that all these parameters that we have got to know today are certainly also dependent on further environmental variables, most relevantly temperature. The interplay with that very parameter, which will again give us very deep fundamental insight, is on the agenda of our next lesson unit.